I decided that I would talk to you about something of relevance to your careers. And those of you who are in the religion class have recently been studying Buddhism, and as a subdivision of that, you have been studying Zen Buddhism. And you may well know that the practice of Zen Buddhism has a very special relationship to what the Japanese call Bushido, which is the way of the warrior. It may seem surprising to some people that Buddhism could have any concern whatsoever with the military arts. But let's face it, if we are going to have military arts, and if we are going to have military people at all, they must be as effective as possible. It is a very bad thing to cut off a person's head half-heartedly. To leave your enemy with a half-severed head is not gentlemanly at all. And therefore, there has to be extreme swiftness of action. I was saying at lunch with our friends here that Germany lost 2 world wars because of the goose step. You should never hear a soldier coming. Well now, this has unexpected consequences, because of what I'm really doing is giving you a talk on occult strategy. Because I think one of the difficulties that we are having in this country today in its foreign policies is a certain defect of strategy. And this strategy is a very marvelous subject, because it's a nitty-gritty subject which sentimental people tend to avoid. We have to realize that these things do exist in the world and have to be handled. And you cannot be a good strategist unless you are also a philosopher. And you cannot be a good philosopher unless you're also something of a mystic. I know that's a sort of dirty word in intellectual circles, and I sometimes refer to mysticism as ecological awareness. Makes it a bit more respectable in the academic world. Now, for those of you who don't know what Zen is, I will just say briefly that it's a Sino-Japanese form of Buddhism which evolved in the Tang Dynasty, which was shortly after 700 AD. It had Indian inspiration, but it was largely a mixture of Indian Buddhism and Chinese Taoism. Taoism is the philosophy of nature in China. It is best exemplified in our own culture by the art of sailing. Go with the wind. And if you need to go in a different direction from that in which the wind is going, tack. But it is a much more intelligent way of negotiating oneself than rowing. Rowing involves an undue strain. And the absolute principle that is involved in Taoism and which enters into Zen is that all fine effort never strains. Anybody completely accomplished in the use of force, by which I mean energy, because force sometimes means strain, knows that you achieve your best results by following gravity, or by going with the grain of things. And you know this if you've practiced surf riding, you know this if you've ever flown a plane, you know this in every kind of athletic discipline. You must not strain. Use your weight properly. It's weight that counts, and intelligence. Weight plus intelligence, because weight is mass, and mass is energy. So that was the Taoist's point of view. Taoism originated in China, probably between around 400 BC, and is associated in particular with a lovely book called in Chinese Dao De Jing, the book of the way and its power. And you should all read it in Lin Yutang's translation in the modern library, called The Wisdom of Lao Tzu. It is a book written as a manual of instruction for rulers. And it has a great deal in it to say about military tactics. And it shows you how to do more with less. It is, of course, like Zen, in common with Zen, the philosophy underlying Judo. Do is the Japanese way of pronouncing the Chinese word Dao. Dao meaning, as I said, the course of nature. And Judo means the gentle way. The way of defending oneself without using force. Using strength, yes, but you never force it. Like when you put a key in a lock and there's difficulty in turning it. If you simply use brute muscle, you'll bend the key or break the lock. You jiggle instead. Or you put some oil on it and jiggle again. And you find the easy way through. So then, Zen being a combination of that philosophy of going with the stream and Buddhist philosophy comes out as something like this. Buddhist philosophy is concerned with awakening, with waking up, with being awake. And the word Buddha means simply an awakened man, or the awakened man. Now, what is it to be awake? We have to contrast this with what it is to be asleep. To be asleep, in a way, is to be hypnotized. To fail to be sufficiently aware of reality. And the way in which all civilized people hypnotize themselves and get into terrible trouble is through too much of a good thing. That is to say, through being enchanted or spellbound by words, concepts, and measures. Which constitute a system of description of nature, which we confuse with nature. The map, in other words, is not the territory. The word is not the event. Water is an undrinkable noise. And it's tremendously important to observe that distinction. This is the basis, of course, of Korzybski's philosophy called general semantics. But we, as a culture, significantly fail to observe this distinction. And that's why we're in trouble. For example, we confuse money with wealth. You can't eat money. No amount of stock certificates and dollar bills are of the slightest use to you on a desert island. Their value as wealth simply disappears. But you can add figures to each other indefinitely. And pile it up, but you cannot eat 5 roasts of beef at one meal. Or drive in 3 cars at once, or live in 6 houses at once. There is a limit to the material one can consume. And the United States, which is regarded all over the world and by itself as a materialistic civilization, is nothing of the kind. A materialist is a person who loves material. Do our cities look as if they were made by people who loved material? Is it materially smart to live in the middle of poison gas? So, military men, who are supposed to be realists above all people, should have their eye on material and value. So that's what Zen is all about. But in order, you see, to be really aware of the real world, you have from time to time to practice being silent. I don't mean the kind of silence where, you know, there's been a death of some very important citizen and somebody gets up and says, let's observe a minute of silence in his honor. And everybody frowns and thinks very grave thoughts. That's not silence. Silence, as they practice it in Zen, it is called Zazen, which means sitting Zen, is the temporary suspension of thinking. And by thinking, I mean specifically talking to oneself inside the skull. Using descriptive symbolisms, whether they be words or numbers or whatever, instead of looking directly at what is, at reality. Because if I were to talk all the time, I would have nothing to talk about because I wouldn't hear what you had to say. Likewise, if I talk to myself all the time, if I think all the time, I have nothing to think about except thoughts. And that is the great academic fallacy. I'm not against the intellectual life. I'm an intellectual. I make my living by writing books and giving lectures and things, by being a philosopher. But to have anything to philosophize about, you must occasionally be silent. And I'm going to explain why in some detail. But that's what Zen is primarily concerned with, is the cultivation of inner silence. Now, you might ask me then, what is reality? What am I talking about that we experience through silence? Some people say that the real world is material. But that is really a philosophical concept. It's a sort of 17th, 18th century form of Western philosophy called materialism. But it's purely conceptual. The idea that all this is some sort of stuff composed of ultimate billiard balls of matter is purely a mythology. There is the alternative idea that everything is mental, as in subjective idealism, as in Christian Science, that it's reality is spiritual or mental or psychic. That also is a conception. Reality itself is you can say that is a clap, but it wasn't. Clap is a different noise from. So wake up. But to wake up, you have to be quiet. So Zazen involves the discipline of stillness, mental stillness. I say discipline. I suppose that word shouldn't frighten you. It does to many people. I really prefer to call it a skill. Because discipline so often indicates something where you are forced by superior authority to follow a certain course of action. That is not real discipline, because it isn't self-discipline. It's mere submission. But real discipline is a delicious thing. You can't have any pleasure without discipline. You can't even get roaring drunk without the discipline of the distiller's art. So, there is no pleasure without discipline. You can't sail a boat without discipline. So, but it should be all disciplines that are effectively followed are delightful. Obviously, you know this, if there's some form of athletics that you like to perform, if you like flying a plane, it's something extremely interesting to do. And that's why you devote attention to it and develop the skill and so on. So this discipline of interior silence is practiced by Zen students and has been so in Japan since the 12th century. Now, what happens is a very curious thing, because this discipline differs from all others in one very odd respect. It has no purpose. Because if you do it for a result in the future, you're not doing it. Because you will discover in the state of mental silence that is called in Japanese mushin, meaning literally no mind, or no munen, no thought, you will discover in that state of consciousness that there is no future, and likewise no past. There is only now. And now is all that there ever was and all that there ever will be. And until you know that secret, making plans is of no use to you whatsoever. Because when your plans mature, you won't be there to enjoy them. You'll be making plans for somewhere else. Plans are of use only to those who live totally now and realize, of course, that their memories are happening now and that their expectations are likewise happening now. There is only now. And that insight comes as a result of clarifying one's mind as if it were a completely clear mirror, or an unruffled pool reflecting the sky and showing by transparency what lies at the bottom. And that sort of mind is what is achieved in the practice of Zen meditation or Zazen. It goes also along with learning how to breathe. Because Zazen doesn't involve a kind of forced elimination of thoughts or of any sensory input that one may be having. You begin by letting everything happen which is happening. Let your ears hear whatever they want to hear. Let your eyes see whatever they want to see. Let your lungs breathe as they will. And let your nerve ends distributed all over your body feel anything they happen to want to feel. Let go. Don't interfere. And then say, as you listen, without naming, without describing the sounds that are going on all around you, as you feel, without trying to identify what these feelings are, as you let your mind think about whatever it likes, but you listen to your own thoughts as if they were birds chattering outside, then you begin to discover reality. You don't get a concept of reality. You get reality itself. Now that's tremendously important, because all our concepts of reality, all our descriptions of it, whether in words or in mathematical formulations, are linear. Words are strung out in a line. Thoughts are strung out in a line. And therefore we say, you can only think of one thing at a time. But to be effective in life, you must be able to think of innumerable things at once, or at least deal with them. But you cannot do that with linear thinking, because nature is non-linear. Nature is everything happening altogether everywhere at once. To put it in scientific language, nature involves billions of variables. Whereas in thought, the average person cannot entertain more than four variables at once without using a pencil. We can comprehend the millions of variables, as in physics, by using statistical methods. But average human problems involve, say, 100,000 variables. Maybe even 2,500. How can you think about 2,500 variables at once? But the point is, although your thinking systems cannot do this, your brain can. Your brain takes care of the organization of your body. Every single process of the human organism involves the nervous system. How do you grow your hair? How do you color your eyes? How do you make your glands secrete what they should? How do you beat your heart? How do you breathe? Incidentally, how do you manage to be conscious? Nobody knows, except a few neurologists, and they admit they know very little about it. That means the brain is smarter than the science of neurology. How do you open and close your hand? You say, I know how to open and close my hand, but you can't tell how it's done in words. But you can do it. And therefore, what is necessary is the greater facilitation of the use of the nervous system. And we may miss that by paying too much attention to description. It may be much more important for us to neglect mathematics and physics a little bit. You know, I don't think they should be thrown out of the window by any means. But they will get in our way, and we will make serious mistakes through technology if we do not study the spontaneous use of the brain and learn how to act spontaneously without any thinking. Now, this is where Zen comes in very strongly. Zen operates, aside from cultivating mental silence, in a kind of interchange between teacher and student. An example of such an interchange is the following story. A Zen teacher, or Roshi, as he's called in Japan, was walking through the forest with a group of his students. Suddenly he picked up a branch and turned to one of his students and said, "What is it?" And the student hesitated. So the Roshi hit him with it. He turned to another student and said, "What is it?" And the student said, "Give it to me so that I can see." So the Roshi touched the branch, and the student caught it and hit the Roshi. "Ah," I said the Roshi, "you had me there." Another story that's like it is, the teacher was entertaining four students to tea, three students, giving them tea. He pulled his fan out and tossed it to the first student and said, "What is it?" He said, "It's a fan." "Ah." Gave it to the next student. He opened it and fanned himself. "Not bad." And he turned it to the third student. The third student opened it, put a cookie on it, and handed it to the teacher. See, he had no fixed idea of it is a fan. The word, or this use only, it could become a tray. It was a magical object, you see. He could transform its use into many different things. And all inventive and creative people. Why they're inventive, why they're creative, is because they're not hung up on fixed definitions of what any form of life or reality may be. So then, as a result of that kind of insight, it became very valuable to the Japanese samurai to study it. First of all, they wanted to overcome the fear of death. And they found they couldn't frighten Zen teachers. Now, why not? Why are we afraid of death? Obviously, because we're thinking about it all the time. Because we've been taught to be afraid of death. When we were babies, we had no fear of death. We didn't even know about it. And yet when we got sick, our parents and people came and wrung their hands over us. We were having a gas, enjoying some sort of trance or weird fever state. And the parents came around and said, "Oh, it's awful, it's awful, it's awful, poor baby. Oh, it's a doddy bobby doddy on all that." And the baby learns from this that something horrible is happening. And the baby can't do anything about it. There's no good teaching it to worry. And furthermore, if you do know about disease and you're a surgeon, you don't want to be so concerned about your patients that your hand shakes when you're operating. So we've made a bogey out of death. I mean, death is how do you know you're alive unless you were once dead? How do you know you exist, that existence is something there, unless you once didn't? So existence and non-existence, life and death, they don't vibration. It's like the crest of a wave, the trough of a wave, and so on. You can't have a trough without a crest, or a crest without a trough. So you can't have existence without non-existence. It just doesn't make any sense at all. You may be afraid of the way of dying, being burned up or something. But that becomes a problem to you if you think about it in advance. You're not being burned up now, and now is the only reality. Sufficient to the day is the trouble thereof. But it's because we have this over emphasis on tat 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 talk 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 going on inside the skull all the time that we worry. And then we worry because we worry. And we know that's not doing us any good. So that was the first thing the samurai wanted to discover, how not to be afraid of death. And so the Zen teachers taught them how to act without thinking. And this requires an enclosed discipline, because if you're always used to acting on the basis of thinking, and you suddenly switch to the other method, you may make some very foolish mistakes. So it's always done within a kind of enclosure, like this is an academy, like there is a special school for Zen, where everybody understands certain rules, and outsiders are not interfered with by the process of what's going on here. They're not bugged by it. Outsiders would be very easily bugged by people who acted spontaneously, without due consideration. But you see, it's absolutely necessary for the samurai to act without due consideration. Because when you're in a sword fight, there isn't time to think. But also, you have to be intelligent. It isn't simply a method of learning a set of reactions. Those of you who study judo, you know very well that it isn't merely a matter of learning a routine of reactions, and therefore being able to bring them on for almost any kind of assault that may be made against you. You never completely know what kind of assault may be made against you. So if you go out routinely prepared for different kinds of assault, and something turns up that you never ran into before, you're lost. It's like the beginning psychiatrist, who's read all the textbooks and knows this kind of a case and that kind of a case, and then suddenly he gets out into practice, and here is somebody who's got something that never was discussed in the textbooks. So he rings up his teacher and says, "Now what do I do with a thing like that?" So what is important, you see, is not the study of different techniques of strategy, but having your consciousness made over to where it understands situations without thinking about them, just as you understand how to breathe, how to open and close your hands. And so there is a wonderful essay by a Zen master called Takuan on the art of swordsmanship.
And he says, it is absolutely important in this art to have what he calls immovable intelligence. And in our language, we would say the awakened intelligence of the brain, unobstructed by any preconceived ideas. So he says, when the hands are clapped, the sound issues immediately, without a moment's hesitation. You know, it isn't. So when a flint is struck, the spark comes out instantly. Now he says, this doesn't mean that you hurry, because hurrying itself is a block. You know how in psychology we use the term mental block, where you hesitate as to how something should be done. And our proverb says, he who hesitates is lost. Even though another proverb says, look before you leap. But that looking, you see, is not necessarily pondering. It is just using your eyes as the immediate sensor of the brain. And you move right into it. So that you must not be involved in any considerations of either winning this fight or losing it. If you want to win, that's a mental block. If you're afraid of losing, it's a mental block. You know how it is sometimes when you act in a crisis. You're driving a car and the thing skids. You suddenly find something come over you where you act without any premeditation. Often you do the right thing. You only get the shakes afterwards when you think about it. So in that kind of a crisis, what the Zen master Takuan meant by immovable wisdom takes over. So that is the primary thing that has to be learned in those various athletic or military disciplines which Zen influenced. It would be kendo, or sword fighting, judo, karate, aikido, which is the most esoteric of all of them, and that is the art of being unattackable. Everybody should study aikido, especially if you're a military people. Because the greatest skill in the military art is not to be able to be attacked. And this does not necessarily mean granite and strong fortifications. We come to it in the end in the highest school of Japanese swordsmanship. And if any of you get an opportunity or can rent a 3-night film, it's 3 2-hour strips, called Samurai, done by Mifune in color. It is the life story of Miyamoto Musashi. You should show it here. It is an absolutely thrilling story, done with the greatest artistry, leading up to a final battle in which Musashi is very reluctant to engage, but he has to do so as a pundona, or point of honor. Where he comes at his opponent, who has a huge long sword, with an oar, a wooden oar, and he defeats him by timing. He walks in from the sea to the beach to meet this man for the duel. And he's timed it just exactly so that at the critical moment the sun will rise and be in it to his opponent's eyes. See, that's intelligence. So then, the highest school of swordsmanship is called the no-sword school. A very kind of elementary illustration of it was that Musashi was once taking a ferry boat across Lake Biwa near Kyoto. And at the last minute, a very drunk samurai stepped on the boat. He was one of these machismo types, a very aggressive, gruff. I'll fight any man on the boat. He so turns to Musashi and says, you're a samurai, aren't you? You got a sword there. Come out. And Musashi said, now wait. There are lots of other people on this boat. And if we fight, we may hurt innocent bystanders. Ferryman, you go over to that little island over there, and we'll get out on that island and fight. So the ferryman went over to the island. And this drunken fellow, who was all eager to fight, leapt out onto the island. Musashi grabbed the oar from the ferryman and pushed the boat away, left this man stranded on the island. That's the no-sword school. But in a more profound way, the no-sword school is you must first understand the nature of power and consider that the basic thing to know in all strategy is what do you want? Now, do you really want power? Would you like to be able to control everything absolutely? You know, it would be like making love to a plastic woman. No surprises. No enlightenment. So be very careful of the ideal of power. And this is a thing that gets into men in the culture of the West all too easily. Because a lot of men are not confident of their masculinity and therefore make a show of masculinity. And they think that it's male always to play tough. Well, they're kind of angry about things, right? And therefore they ignore anything subtle. It used to be said of this academy that there was an entrance test, and that if you could recognize Vivaldi or Giotto, you would be rejected. I have a feeling that's probably a rumor. But you see, a man who is not afraid that he is a man, who has all the strength and courage and sexual capacity of a man, is not afraid of gracefulness, of a certain sensitivity. Because if you don't have that, you can't make a good soldier. Because you will be unalert, stupid. Like the people you know who just think, "Kapang!" is the whole art of war. The whole art of war is judo. Is be quiet. Be very, very alert. But you can't try to be alert. You can't force alertness. All right, I'm looking at the time. But if that clock were further away, and it was blurry, and I stare at it, I won't make it any clearer. If I relax my eyes, imagine a black velvet curtain in a dark room, and then open my eyes gently. The light comes to me on its own. And that, again, is the Taoist art of non-forcing things. Sailing, treating the whole of life as navigation. And this, above all, the air pilot must understand. You're not a man who wants a firm foundation under his feet. The trouble is, so much of our religion is based on analogies of a rock. We need firm ground to stand on. And people get narrow-minded. Because life is fluid. So the sailor understands better the way things are. He doesn't want a firm rock, but the last thing he wants, that's trash. Even so, even more with the airman, you are working in a still more fluid thing, and you don't know which way is up sometimes. But you don't talk about up, you talk about out. Going out or coming in. But there's no up. Everybody's up is different. It depends where you stand on the globe. You find out eventually that you are on a spaceship already. It's called Earth. You don't need to go rushing off to the moon in rockets. Because that's again, boom! No, well, it's sort of phallic symbol.
What you do,
strategically, you see, is you cultivate very sensitive radio astronomy. So that you'll never get to the nearest star in several lifetimes. You may establish a nice space station outside the Earth where you don't have atmosphere to bother the telescopes. That's okay. But the future of the knowledge of the universe lies in letting it come to us. It's again the Taoist principle. So in all those things you do which seem on the surface to require brute force, see if you can use another technique. The story you know of the meeting of Richard I, the Lionheart King, with the Sultan. And Richard draws his enormous two-handed sword, you know, and takes an iron bar and goes, bam, you know, and breaks it. The Sultan draws his scimitar. He floats a piece of silk into the air. And it drops on the scimitar and is severed. See? That made everybody very frightened. But that's the principle that underlies the Taoist doctrine of going with the stream and of not forcing it, and the Zen doctrine of getting to reality, which is always now, and which you can comprehend without always having to figure it out in words.